Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is veterinarian Claire Berrien. Berrien is a graduate of the Cornell College of Veterinary Medicine. She worked in several small animal hospitals and in 1996 opened her own business, Ithaca Vet House Call Services. It features in-home health care, advice, end-of-life counseling, and euthanasia for cats, dogs, and exotic pets. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
Now, I understand that you got the idea to go into some form of medicine from your parents. Tell us how they influenced you.
I think it might have been destiny. My mother was an RN, and my dad was a pharmacist. So from an early age, I was comfortable hearing discussions regarding, you know, medicines and health. And then from a pretty young age, I actually steered my own path, found what I think was a calling for animal medicine as opposed to human medicine.
Uh-huh. And were your parents okay with that, or did they try to steer you into human medicine?
They were supportive always of me, very much. However, my mother was a nurse and liked everything meticulously clean, so for many years we were not allowed to have a furred pet in the house.
Really?
But she finally gave in when we were a little bit older children. So uh-huh. Then we had a dog.
So you discovered that you wanted to be a veterinarian even before you had pets?
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I've met other veterinarians who felt a sense of a calling very early in their lives, too, meaning 5, 6, 7 years old. That's the romantic, ideal part of it. Later, you have to know that you're what it's really all about and that you're willing to commit to the realities of the career.
Yeah.
But in terms of initial calling, I really believe it is a calling, and that many of us feel it from such a young age and so profoundly that we have almost no choice. I followed some tangential paths along the way. I was also interested in animal behavior and psychology. And despite some tangential paths, that calling always came back to me. So.
Wow. Oh, it's so good to know. It's so good to know that people feel that passion.
They do,
for
I
something.
Think. Many veterinarians
well,
do.
Well, tell us how vet school is similar to medical school. I mean, you probably don't know intimately, but you have to learn anatomy. You still have to go through some of the same rigorous training.
Very much so.
Uh-huh. Talk to us about that.
Essentially 8 years, because 4 years undergraduate, and then if you go right on to veterinary college, that's another 4 years. And many people then do an internship or residency now for specialty services. I did not at the time. It wasn't quite as common as it is today. But another way people go about it is after graduation, being thrown into the tumult of the real world and working at hospitals and seeing patients and learning from senior veterinarians, So, uh-huh. And it's a lifelong learning experience.
Yeah, I would imagine.
One never stops learning. That's very comparable to human medicine.
Uh-huh. And do you learn general disciplines instead of going into specialization? I mean, do you learn how to do surgeries? Do you mm-hmm. learn how to do these things? And then if you want to specialize, you go into more study in
right,
those directions?
Right, and we certainly don't learn every possible procedure or every possible test and so forth, but we certainly had trials by fire of learning the very fundamentals and certain standard procedures, and from there, one jumps off. We observed residents and senior staff veterinarians doing much more sophisticated mm-hmm. surgeries, for instance, spinal surgery and so forth. And then one has the choice again of going through an internship and then a residency in specifically, say, an area of surgery, soft tissue surgery or orthopedics and mm-hmm. Internal medicine.
Well, what was one of the things that you were particularly interested in? All of it, or did you have a specialty?
I, right through vet school and throughout my life, really, had a variety of species, dealt with a variety of species, mm-hmm. and I worked in what was called the wild avian clinic. So we got in, still to this day that exists, but people would bring in injured birds of all sorts, raptors and so forth, and I was a student of many who volunteered in that area, had an interest in exotic animal medicine, which wasn't as developed during the days I was there as it is now. It's much more highly developed now. In fact, a classmate and dear friend of mine is the chief of exotic animal medicine at Cornell, so he came back and did that. So perhaps because I grew up doing animal behavior, working with lots of rodent species and interested in birds and just a variety of animal species. That was one of my major interests. Always interested in animal behavior and just very attracted to being around animals. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, you know what I would wonder about? I would wonder about anesthesia for some of these exotic animals. It's a trial and error.
No,
isn't it?
I mean, perhaps it was at one time, as was all anesthesia, including human anesthesia. I actually did a special extra rotation during a summer in intensive anesthesia, where I was involved with both small animal and large animal, horse and cow and so forth, anesthesia, and met one of the most wonderful people I've ever known, Dr. Andrea Looney, who is now a boarded anesthesiologist and wonderful person. So she was a mentor in that, and I did special extra training in anesthesia. And it is still a learning experience. And what I've come to find, whether human or animal, is every individual is literally an individual. So one has a protocol, but one must always be flexible and attentive to monitoring and to taking into account factors that might influence the type of anesthesia you would use initially anyway. Their gas anesthesia we have today is much safer than it was, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, so that's fascinating.
We're fortunate that
way.
And exotic animals, actually, I've done a number of various exotic animals with sedation or anesthetic protocols, and I haven't found that to be particularly troubling. That's good.
Yeah, well, anesthesia is always thought of as pretty dangerous. It's one of the more dangerous aspects of surgery for
people.
People
worry
people.
About that a lot, and it is. It's why we have people sign a permission form. There are dangers, but generally speaking, even a 19-year-old cat, as long as its general health and blood work appears to be okay for anesthesia, can be really quite safely anesthetized these days, for instance, to have terrible rotting teeth removed that might cause a reduction in the length or quality of that animal's life. And I've done a 19-year-old cat, and that little girl was eating better that evening than she had eaten in the past several weeks.
Wow, that's good to know.
So people shouldn't be too terrified about anesthesia with the vets who are monitoring and using the up-to-date protocols.
Wow. Well, I want to talk about the fact that you did work in several small animal hospitals, and then you segued into your own business in 1996. What made you decide to take that leap?
I think what I've always enjoyed is relationship with people. I've had a lot of experience with that. Animal behavior and the connections made. And in hospital situations, all of that is there, but it's often under a lot of intense pressure. And in more recent years, that kind of pressure, as you must have experienced as an animal lover and owner, is even greater. Often the hospital might be terribly busy and an emergency might come in at the same time that you were trying to talk to someone about his or her ill pet. In the house visits, it's calmer, more relaxed. Cats in particular, and older dogs or dogs with fear of cars and so forth. But cats in particular, we know as a rule, absolutely hate traveling by car. They do much better at home as a rule. Some of the cats who've been politely asked not to return as patients, and some of the dogs who fit that bill as well, or birds, you know, some have been disinvited from repeat visits to a previous veterinarian. And so I have seen many of those animals. So I'm also used to dealing with a very wide variety of personality types. But the home visits really allow for a better situation for the animal in many ways, a calmer situation.
And it sounds like it was better for you, too. You wanted to have more of an intimate relationship.
It allowed me that time to actually talk and communicate well with owners, to also assess, for instance, the animal husbandry or the environment and perhaps provide some insights and assistance with ideas for whether exotic pets and how they're housed and cared for, or even cats or dogs and how they are living and what I can do to assist the owner in making the best quality possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, but what do you do about cats? I mean, I have a cat that runs and hides for days if strangers come into my house. How do you deal with that? Do you have people cage them up before you arrive?
I've often said I could write, of the many books I could write, one could be The Bathrooms of Tompkins County, because as a feline house call, what I often do if I assess by telephone that a cat is skittish or of strangers or veterinarians is arrange to call right before I leave to go to the person's house, and they sequester the animal in a convenient location where there aren't holes or beds to get under, and that is often a bathroom. So many of my cat patients have in fact been seen in a bathroom, and it works tremendously well.
That's a good idea.
And also, even if they're stressed, what I do note in the house call visits is many times, instead of just disappearing or trembling and being kind of in a daze, a cat will wander over, know it's done somehow, wander over and start eating. And especially people who know cats know that that's a very good sign. So not all of them do that. Some will go and disappear or be angry with the owner, but many times it helps them out quite a bit.
Do you have to have special license to do in-home? And what kind of...
So far, it's an option, and more recently, there's actually an association of house call veterinarians. 10 years ago, people were constantly shocked that I did house calls or that house calls were available, and that's become a growing subspecialty. It's not an official board certified specialty at this time, but it's definitely become a much more popular option, even in large cities. So, and then I also get to deal with, this is another important aspect of it. I have a sister with a developmental disability, sensitive to people with disabilities or health issues. I certainly work with many dying clients, and the intimacy of the home visit is very, very important for people with those sorts of challenges. And also the relationships are very, very important.
Yeah, I want to talk to you. That's good that we segued into this. I want to talk to you about end-of-life issues with animals. You specialize in that, it seems to me.
It's a big part, frankly, of every veterinarian's practice. For every veterinarian, end-of-life counseling and euthanasia issues, quality of life issues, maintaining quality and doing palliative care, all of that is inherently a part of every single practicing veterinarian's practice. So I am not saying that that's unusual. However, it is another area that now is arising with an association of veterinarians who do what they are calling hospice and palliative care. Frankly, I'm very well aware of what hospice care is because my mother was in that kind of care. There is no truly hospice care for animals. What there is palliative end-of-life care with a lot of support of the client, both emotionally and in terms of medical advice and assistance with administering treatments and giving treatment options. So it is palliative care with the goal being extending quality of life and then providing for the most humane, peaceful passing when that time comes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is veterinarian Claire Berrien. I want to talk to you about this. We were talking about euthanasia and end of life. How do you deal with clients who aren't ready to let go and you know the animal needs to be let go? Does it break your heart, and do you take steps to try to change outcomes?
It certainly affects me. Again, these are often very intimate relationships. Sometimes intimate, although they're very new relationships. I may never have been the veterinarian for the animal in question, may never have met the owner prior to a diagnosis of a sudden and maybe severe deadly and condition, cancer or whatnot. What I do is adapt. I'm always adapting to the situation, and there's a triadic relationship, pet or patient, veterinarian, and client, which is unique to veterinary medicine. It exists in no other field. So that triad is very important. And yes, I have to be sensitive to the issue of the animal. Is this animal suffering and so forth? Suggest to the owner some things we know to look for, that sometimes the owner might not realize to look for. For instance, a dog might not be whining, but might be panting or not able to become comfortable pacing or and so forth. Mm-hmm. A cat might be trying to hide quite a lot, and subtle things that individual animals might exhibit that might help the owner to understand that in a certain sense, his or her animal is suffering. Mm. And then I've spent literally months with a given client doing phone consultation. It's a lot of almost therapy. It's certainly counseling. Now, you know, I don't have a degree in that, but I do have a very strong background in psychology. That has assisted me greatly. And sometimes people call me when their animal is first diagnosed with, for instance, a terminal cancer. And I work in conjunction with them and perhaps their regular veterinarian so that I can do a house visit, minimizing the animal's stress level, and do a lot of phone consultations with the person. And toward the end, that might turn into from once a month or once every couple of weeks to once a week. And in the very end, literally once every day to more than one time a day. So I adapt based on the needs of the person and the animal as long as I can determine that that animal is not suffering too greatly. And I've had every single kind of situation from an immediate euthanasia just recently during I was going to leave for the Ithaca Festival, and a dog with cancer just diagnosed the night before was doing very poorly, and it was a very sudden, urgent need for humane euthanasia.
Wow.
To some animals who do very well with palliative care for quite a long time, and then perhaps are facing the final days or hours.
Yeah, so. Well, those are the saddest times for all of us who love animals. Now, you don't do surgeries in these house calls, right?
No.
So when you find that there's a need for surgery or something more extensive, you send people to hospitals. You have contracts with, or contacts at least with?
Contacts, not contracts. Uh-huh. But we discuss options. A lot of my clients might have a regular veterinarian, as you might put it, with a hospital or clinic to whom they go for certain things, but they prefer that some routine matters. There are a lot of routine things that can be done in the home, but certainly any procedures requiring a significant level, full anesthesia, such as dentistry or major surgery, spays, neuters, tooth removals, and so forth, biopsies, internal biopsies have to be done in a hospital, cardiac workups, ultrasound, and so forth. So I know all the options in Ithaca very well, and I can discuss those with owners and also try to adjust with them the decision process to what they're able to do financially, which in these days is a very big factor.
Oh, absolutely.
So I can suggest some things to them and give them some options and help them that way to decide what they can do for their animal.
I always ask people this, pet owners, vets, everybody I know, why is it, do you think, people still neglect to spay and neuter? There's always such a problem with kittens, puppies, homeless.
I've had that brought, you know, starkly to me in a question on the internet from a person who didn't want to spay his dog. And I have to say it causes me some consternation, as it does, I think, probably all veterinarians, because so many, probably hundreds of thousands of animals must be put to death every year for the lack of good homes. And we see that our local SPCA is the most tremendous facility for trying to save lives, and we have also a tremendously supportive population here. But we're somewhat unique in many communities. There isn't as good a system set up, and so many animals are still put to death.
I can't believe people resist it. Yeah, people resist it for the strangest reasons.
They do seem to be irrational to me. We even have, for people who perhaps might take it personally, that a male dog is neutered, there are now artificial testicles that can be implanted if it's an aesthetic problem.
Ah.
So there really aren't any rational arguments that make sense to me, other than if someone is actively in a breeder and selling purebred animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about people getting insurance for their pets? Do you think that makes sense?
There is still a debate. I'm always asking people who have opted for it. There aren't that many I've found who have opted for it, but I'm asking them for feedback all the time about, there are only a couple of major named insurance carriers for pets that seem to be suggested. I've had mixed comments about that. Mm-hmm. Some clients feel that it's been a tremendous investment in terms of payback, that they might have had, say, a terrible accident and it would have cost thousands and it really helped a lot. And then others have had less favorable experiences where they tried to submit routine care bills that should be covered according to the policy and had a lot of difficulty with it. So I think that can become better, but at least it's there. And there's another program called Care Credit at some of the major hospitals, Cornell, for instance, where we know if it's going to be several thousand dollars serious bill, this allows you, if you're certified to receive it, you have 6 months in which to pay off your bill with no interest at all.
Oh.
And even for us veterinarians, what many people don't understand is most of us aren't wealthy. And so for our own pets, if we have to have orthopedic surgery for $2,000 or $3,000, having an option of Care Credit, even for us, is really helpful. We might not be able to do it without that. So.
Oh, that's good to know. Now, you visit people's houses, so you see intimately what's happening. How do you deal with people when you think they're neglecting animals, abusing animals? Did you try to talk to them first before you report?
Yes, I definitely do. And sometimes that is very successful, and sometimes it's very, very, very frustrating.
Mm.
There continues to be a rather fine line between what I would call neglectful or somewhat hoarding, quasi-neglectful behavior, where, say, large dogs are kept in very confined spaces all day long, every day of their lives, and there are 10 dogs in one small home. To me, that's unacceptable, and it is a form of abuse. But if the people are feeding them adequately, not beating the dogs, and not meeting the actual standards of animal control for feeling compelled to take those animals, then they are allowed to stay in that environment. And the best we can do as veterinarians is talk in a reasonable way, as best we can, in a compassionate way with the clients, and point out, too, that each of those animals will cost a certain amount of money and medical bills throughout its life, perhaps more in some years than others. And the people have to remember they need to be able to put food on their own tables and to have their own health care. So perhaps one dog rather than 10 dogs would be the ideal situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes people listen and we make progress, and other times it's very sad and heartrending, but we do the best we can.
I'm sure that's a hard subject, and I'm, you know, going into people's houses, you must see it more than would be able to surmise.
I've seen very wonderful things, many wonderful things, and some really, really terrible things that stay with me.
Well, what do you think about alternative medicine for animals? I knew somebody in San Francisco who did acupuncture and seemed to have good
outcomes. I've seen acupuncture. Dr. Looney, to whom I referred earlier, who's a board-certified anesthesiologist, was one of the first people in this area to be certified in veterinary acupuncture for small animals. And I have seen acupuncture performed on a dog and been absolutely impressed at how that dog relaxed. I had done a lot of graduate work in psychology, and specifically in neuropsychology, neuroscience, and I would have to say there are natural endorphins. There's something to acupuncture. I don't know acupuncture. I'm not an alternative practitioner, but I certainly know who some of the local people are who do practice, say, homeopathy or alternative techniques. And I don't discount anything. I think part of being a good clinician, whether an MD or a DVM, is to maintain an open mind and to be open to clients' questions, patients' questions in the case of human medicine, and to realize and really adhere to that commitment to lifelong learning, because there's always more to learn.
Oh, yeah. So. And I'll bet your psychology background, even though it wasn't your main background, has helped so much, because mm-hmm. you have to deal with so many people.
It has helped
so many personalities.
And having a sister with a disability has helped tremendously. I think I have a lot of empathy for people in a wide variety of difficult circumstances. And my clients have taught me a lot over the many. I've been doing this for 20 years, although the business isn't quite that old, but I was doing it before that, too. And in 20 years, I've learned an awful lot from my clients.
Yeah, and I'm always incredibly excited when I hear that people want to be lifelong learners. It just makes so much sense to me that you wouldn't just stop somewhere.
Well, certainly not in medicine.
You know, we've made so many advances in medicine. Do you think there'll ever be a time when cats and dogs will live longer? I know some are now somewhat, but there is going to be we try to advance human longevity and
with quality is the goal,
yeah,
of course.
Uh-huh.
And you could speak to that personally because you happen to be the person of a 17-year-old cat. And when I began in all this, that was pretty astounding. People would consider a 12-year-old elderly.
I remember that.
And nowadays, I many times get to make the comment to someone who presents his or her cat as old, and then proceeds to tell me the cat's 11, that in these days, 11 is not so much what we consider a very elderly cat. So we've already, due to, I think, much better health care, and that involves very much the people who have the animals mm-hmm. getting involved and bringing them in to receive health care, they are living longer. The cats are definitely living longer, and the dogs are living longer, too, providing that the cancer, which, of course, that's a dreadful thing for people and animals. If that comes up, one can't help that sometimes. But in general, animals are living longer because they're no longer, as a rule, treated as farm animals or property. They're really much more family members now.
And they used to be work animals. Yeah. You know, people get cats just to get rid of rats and so on.
Oh, yeah. And even people's goats now. I'll see people who happen to have a couple of goats, and the goats are even cared for in a way that's much more sophisticated than what would have been the case 10 or 15, 20 years
ago. Yeah, yeah. Well, we only have a couple minutes left, Claire. Can you tell us about how animals have enhanced your life and changed your life, and how would your life be the same without them?
Not at all. They are my life, both personally, on a personal basis, my own animals, and those have varied from the smallest rodents and to birds, to iguanas, green iguanas, who must have a specialized environment and care. I'm a big-time dog lover. I love big dogs particularly, but I love all dogs, and I love many cats. My husband happens to be allergic to cats, but I did have a cat in my earlier life, and I have met some of the most wonderful cats. Recently, I've come to feel that they have a tremendous sense of humor, and if you'll notice, recently there are some books coming out about that sense of humor, uh-huh. the feline sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah, they do. I find them magic. I have always found cats incredibly magic.
It's just always part of my life. In fact, I often enter a house and I'm drawn. It might seem impolite, but by nature, I'm drawn immediately to the animal and have to remind myself to stand up and address the person.
Well, we are almost out of time. Is there any contact information you can give for people to get in touch with you?
Sure. My business number for Ithaca Veterinary House Call Services is 607-277-9037. You can leave a message for me, since I'm not usually right there at my desk. I'm on the road a lot. And then once we connect, I can provide you further contact information.
Well, thank you so much. Claire Berrien, thank you so much. I've been talking to veterinarian Claire Berrien, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Ted.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.